There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away. So it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and this week I'm joined by the Latvian Eagle, the great Yannis Patelis, in the Meat Eater Incorporated offices here in Bozeman, Montana. And we're going to have a conversation in this episode about ethics. Really, just a Q&A about ethics. Everybody out there listening, we ask you to send us some questions or quandaries around ethical situations and hunting, and you did that in spades, and we really appreciate that, man. There was a lot of responses. We couldn't get to them all, but I think we got some good ones. And the reason why I think Yanni is the best to tackle some of these quandaries is the fact that there's not a whole lot of fluff where the eagle is involved. He kind of says what he means and means what he says. There's not a whole lot of extra verbiage in there. And that's what I like about the eagle. So hopefully you enjoy this episode of The Hunting Collective featuring Yanni Patelis. All right. What are you saying again?
I was saying that you and I were taking deep breaths, getting ready to start podcasting and talking. And it reminded me that I listened to a TED talk. Didn't watch it. I think I just listened. And the gal studied about... it was basically like human body posture and like the sort of endorphins that your body creates as you're in different postures.
Yep.
And like and then she compared like male postures and female postures. The posture that I'm in right now with like the feet kicked up on the table and
yep.
your hands locked, your fingers locked behind your arm, elbows out to the side. She called that like the president. Like or something like that. And there was all these pictures of like Obama and Bush and everybody
that.
Is like at their desk, feet kicked up, and it's a very powerful posture, right? She was saying, so the test that she did, and it was remarkable to listen to this. Like people were going into an interview and some people were just sat in the interview room, curled over their phones, doing whatever, you know, hunched over. The other people were asked to like for 2 minutes, go into the other room and basically stand around like Superman, like arms crossed, chest pumped out, legs kind of spread out, stretch your arms, do some stuff like that. And like, it's like everybody that did that just scored exponentially better.
Really?
By doing that one simple thing. So I try to remember that.
It's a confidence thing?
Yeah. Cause like whatever, I forget the endorphin or chemical, whatever that was released in your body. But and then again, it goes. And she was comparing it to the male versus female thing that in like a classroom setting, it's males assume those postures much more often. And she was saying that might be a big reason that why in a classroom, male might jump up and answer a question faster or sooner, or just feel more confident to do that in the first place.
Well, now I feel a little conscious about my posture right now. I'm a little uncomfortable moving back and forth in my chair.
Well, now I always look at other people now. I'm like, huh, is Ben exhibiting a
presidential posture? Is he, or is he leaning over his phone like a loser in a basement?
Are you confident over there?
I'm relaxed. Good. I'm relaxed. I don't feel...
We should be, man. It's 2 p.m. on a Friday. Mm. It's snowing. We're watching it become white outside. You know.
The week's over. I think we both really kicked ass this week. Yeah. I think you did well. You went at the cookbook launch event downtown Bozeman. You signed,
a couple books.
I think it was upwards of 75 books, I think you signed.
Took a couple pictures with some fans.
Yeah.
We had fans, man, from New Jersey.
Yeah, man. Those guys came up to me. They're like, we were on the plane from, wherever, from D.C.
Oh, that's right.
And I was like, what? You came that far? Oh, yeah, we came from New Jersey. I think they might have came there ironically because of the cat lady comment. You never know. Like, we're going there. But they just came for just that event. And they were like, so what else are you guys doing? They said, we karaoke last night.
They said they tore it up, too.
Yeah, they're like, we tore it up.
Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
Yeah. I was like, everybody sings along with that song. That's the perfect karaoke song.
You know what, man? I'm ashamed, but I'm not like a really good music guy, but I've heard of that song, but I can't right now think,
I've seen a little silhouette of a man. Oh. That's that one.
Which is Queen?
Ah, yes. Yep. I'm probably wrong.
I'm proud of myself.
I'm probably way wrong, but I think that I'm pretty sure that's right. I've often had, write in, if I'm wrong, write in to P.O. Box 1-2. still don't have that P.O. Box set up. Gotta get that going. How's everything else going, Yanni? I mean, you're traveling around a lot, filming season 8 of Meat Eater TV.
Yep.
We're launching a pretty fantabulous cookbook that you were a primary part of. And new company. What's this? Lay it out there. Lay it out there.
Yeah. I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head. And now I'm asked to look to the future and think of other big ideas that we can act upon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got some stuff up my sleeve. I don't know if I'm ready to share it yet, but there's some things
we're working on
that are outside of what everybody's used to reading or listening to. But, yeah, man, exciting times over here.
It very much is.
New,
very much is.
Content creators almost weekly.
Yeah, no, we're cranking out. Yeah, if you're listening to this, you're not going to themeateater.com. Shame on you, you bastards.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good reading on there.
There's not.
Pat Durkin's article on what deer? Pat.
P. Dirk.
P. Oh, you said P.
P. Durkin.
He called him Pete. yeah. But yeah, what deer smell? That was good. I really liked April's article about
killing
or not to kill Marlin.
Yeah, no, Pat's got two more pieces coming out. In fact, one just went live today on how deer smell and how we try to fool them, and I would probably never really fool them. But he also had one on deer vision. You know, Mark Kenyon's doing a lot of stuff around the rut, whitetail lockdown. You know, it's looking good over there. I think we're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get there.
Keeping it fresh.
I think we're keeping it real though, as well. It's real.
Hot tip offs. I can't believe how many people were like, "You got to do this with a hot tip off, or you got to do that with a hot tip off," and I can't believe it. Steve's always winning those hot tip-offs. Your hot tip-offs are
way
always better than Steve's.
Way better. Steve he's got the gravitas, and he knows he's the boss. That's why he's winning. He's got all the cards stacked in his favor.
Listen, man, people always are like, dude, you're always taking a hind tit, you know? I'm like, you guys got to understand that this is my job.
Yeah.
And if my job requires a little bit of that, and the rest of my job is what it is, and I'm very happy to have that and play along.
I am exactly the same way, man. And my former, the job I had prior to this one, it was very much to identify folks like Steve and other people that are very influential and support them in their relationship with Yeti.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like I wasn't the guy doing all the, I wasn't the ambassador. I was the guy supporting those folks. Super fun to do. It's not always fun to be the guy in front. Sometimes it's nice to be
exactly
standing next to the guy.
Yeah, people, it's easy. I think people do recognize that, but it's also easy to forget, man, that the limelight, it's not quite 24/7, but I think it's these days, man, with the internet, it's like it's hard, getting to be that way, and it's a lot of pressure.
And you can't turn it off. You can't just choose to turn it off, especially when you're, you know, when your life is wrapped up in it. You can't be like, I'd like to get out of there.
Until you drop, mic drop, you know, that's when you have to turn it off. But while you're in
you could all do that, yeah, but I don't feel like Steve's doing that or I'm doing that or you're doing that.
Not anytime soon.
Maybe eventually, but
no.
It's too easy to sit in a room and talk. Let's do what? Quick shot out of a cannon. Hot tip off snow related hunting.
Hot tip snow related.
This is like the maybe the new hot tip. Spontaneous hot tip off.
Man,
no planning. Snow related. What things do you do in the snow?
I dealt with some snow last week in Michigan. I'm trying to think what would be a hot tip.
Hot tip in the cold in the tree stand. Hot tip might be even the best.
You know, it almost burned me. It didn't, but. You know, if it's snowing or if it is the snow is melting, be careful how long you wait to blood trail.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did that and ended up waiting like a couple, 3 hours just because we had some other stuff going on. It was cool. I didn't think that, you know, there's no real need to go blood trail immediately. And then we started on the blood trail. And because it had snowed a little bit more, but more it had been melting that it was starting to get hard to follow that blood trail. So beware, you know.
Beware.
Beware of that.
Yeah, my only real hot tip around that is make sure everybody's, you know, you're doing all day sit, be limber. Stand up, stretch your freaking shoulders, stretch, make sure you're moving. Don't be moving around too much that the deer might spot you, but every couple of hours, stand up and stretch it out. Draw your bow maybe if you need to. Be careful not to dry fire the thing, but make sure when you stand up, your muscles aren't so aren't so stiff that you can't draw your bow smoothly because then you get around the tree.
No, man, what I was doing, and I know it definitely could have cost me, but any deer that came through, if it wasn't, well, was or was not the buck or whatever I was trying to shoot at, I would try to draw on it.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be dangerous. Then
you definitely you might need spook to spook them, and then you look back and there's, you know, big boy, but it's good to do because I just feel like that what you gain from doing that, it almost outweighs like the risk you're taking because you do it and all of a sudden you realize like, oh, I didn't see that limb there earlier that I really can't take this shot or
when can I like, okay, the deer's coming from, he's coming in into the wind. I'm safe. He's coming right down this trail. When, you know, so I draw here. Oh, and I draw right back into the camera guy or I draw right back into a limb that's right at this angle. So if you do that, I always, you know, have my shooting lanes and I always draw to each shooting lane. So I kind of have an idea of, oh, here he comes. I'm drawing to the shooting lane. And if he comes different, I can always move. But at least I know kind of like what that motion looks like. And if it's not banging my elbow on a freaking, you know, on a hook or something and making noise. That's my hot tip.
That's good. It's a good hot tip, man. I was doing some of that last week in the cold. I was doing air squats. I think I call them air squats. Isn't an air squat just doing a squat with no weight?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I was doing sets of 30. I felt like that would really bump up my core temp.
Plus your core temp's going. Yeah, so if you're sitting there, I would get to the point where I'd be like, okay, it's 11 o'clock, it's snowing or raining or it's getting super cold, get my phone out, kind of like get myself, you know, have some soup. Do a little like 1 hour phone session so I can my mind can settle and get a little stimulation. And then, you know, even after an hour and a half, you stand back up and you're like, you're stiff. And I had that happen in Illinois like 3 or 4 years ago. I was shooting one of those, shooting like the Bowtech, maybe Insanity. That was a super harsh turnover. The draw cycle is rough. And I had a buck come down the drainage to my right, and I had to turn my entire body because I was kind of the tree stand was facing off to the left. Turn my entire body and draw across my body, and I was so stiff I could barely do it. I got about half draw and I let down and then shift my body so I could get a solid draw. And I'm doing all that while there's a buck at 50 yards, rather than just being at full draw and killing the thing. So, hot tips.
Yeah, there's no one here that can choose a winner.
Spontaneous hot tips. Right in. Tell us the winner.
I'll choose you. I vote for yours.
That was a pretty good one.
That was a good hot tip.
I'm pretty confident about mine.
Although it's a little bit more cold related than it was snow related.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, you've been living in Texas the last few years, so I'll give you a pass.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I could do like rattlesnake related hot tips.
I'd have none for that.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. Ethics. Hunting ethics. I think on this podcast in particular, and also on the Meat Eater podcast, there's a lot of conversation around hunting ethics. And generally, situational hunting ethics. Like, what happens in this situation? What do I do? And so I, a few days ago, asked for folks on the Instagram to submit some stuff so we go over it. So, Yanni, are you prepared to go over some ethical quandaries?
I am. I'm actually Googling ethics definition so that we can – I think that's a good
– yes, that's a good starting point.
Yeah, a baseline of what we're talking about.
What do you got?
Two definitions. Moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. And two would be the branch of knowledge that deals with moral principles.
I like that. Moral principles, what we're talking about. And I guess hunting being the killing of another living thing is pretty fraught with moral and ethical quandaries and principles, both. So this will be a good conversation. We've got a lot of them, so we'll see how many we can get through. But I will start by saying thanks to everybody that wrote in, and I'd like to lead with a light one, if you don't mind, Yanni.
Please.
This came from Calm Pete. He says, is it okay to say hunting is fun anymore? What is your thoughts?
Ethically speaking, for sure. I don't really know if that's even an ethics or a moral question, but
I think it is. I think the way he poses it is not necessarily an ethical question, but I think ethically, it presenting yourself as an ethical hunter, how much joy, how much fun can you display?
That's what he's probably getting at.
Is it ethical from a hunting standpoint to display how much fun you're having when you're putting yourself out there to the public?
Well, it's good to point out too, before we get into that, back to morals and ethics, is that they're always personal.
Of course.
Right? Even though like your community, your family, your community sort of gives you the outline of what they should probably be, you in the end have to decide what they're going to be.
Yep. And they're always determined by your experiences, your perspective, your value systems, like you said, that are either instilled in you or value systems you develop through, you know, your life.
That's right.
And life experiences. So I think.
But this question is more, a little bit more about how, like, you know, someone else is going to judge you.
So, yeah, but I think in general, there's some ethics in hunting around how you display it just because of the situation we're in, you know, because we're.
But for me personally, I definitely talk about hunting and use the word fun.
Yep.
Definitely. Everything, almost everything about it. The killing itself is not always fun. Sometimes it can feel good. Sometimes it can feel bad. But for the most part, yeah, I think it's totally okay to do that. But again, that's like, that's way too simple of an answer because.
Yeah.
You can go nuts with fun and turn it into like a circus. And I don't think that's really cool to apply that to hunting.
Well, I think again, it goes back to the person by person thing. If you know that you're a very emotional person by nature, hunting is going to bring that out in you times too. Because you've just done, you know, if you just talk about specifically about the killing of the thing, is that fun or not? I think that's probably what old Colin Pete's getting at too. Is it ethically... Is my moral principle that I have fun while killing an animal, or killing an animal is fun to me?
Mm-hmm.
Is that morally sound? like to be able to say that, you know. And I would say, like, don't the killing of the animal should be part of the process, but maybe not the fun part. I mean, it can be exhilarating, it could be a lot of things, but I don't know that fun. Maybe we should define fun, but I don't know that fun is the way
fun
I would.
Fun comes in many forms.
That's right. So, is it, you know, can we say, to the question of, can we say hunting is fun? Absolutely, we should say it's fun, because it is. If it's not fun, you're just, you're probably a weirdo. Mm-hmm. We should say it's fun. Now, how we display that fun is another question. I think morally, I think you should display your emotions how they come. You shouldn't be fake about how you display them, but you should also think about when there's other people around you that have never experienced that, how do you get that across them in a way that makes sense? Well, and I think Steve always says, you know, I like meat and I like to have fun. And if hunting, if I lost either of those two things, I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I can agree with that. But so we think it's okay to say it's fun. You agree with that?
I do. Can't take it too seriously.
Don't take it too seriously, we say. Let's get to a little bit longer one. Let's see. This came from Coyote Charlie. He says, I was wondering about fenced hunting. From what I know, you, meaning me, are pretty familiar with Texas. So you might have some thoughts on this. And you've hunted in Texas. But not, have you ever hunted high fence?
No.
Okay.
I've hunted doves that were flying across a high fence range. But I don't. That doesn't count.
That counts.
Yeah. I saw some wild shit when I was in there, but we were not hunting that wild stuff.
High fence hunter. You might have some thoughts. I'm pretty against fenced hunting and the raising of bucks as livestock with unrealistic freakish antlers. So that defines wrong. But as far as fence hunting in general, what do you think about the space for hunting? Is it still fenced hunting if it's 5,000 acres? Obviously, 300 to 500 acres would be a huge place in some areas, but some places not. What do you think about when does it become fair chase, and what's your opinion about the size of the acreage of a high fence ranch? What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. Is there a? I guess this question is. Ethically, in the application of fair chase, is there a point in which it becomes fair chase based on the amount of acreage that is fenced?
Right. And, man, it's going to vary so much from situation to situation. And again, I think you're just going to have to make your own call while you're there. Because it doesn't matter if it's 5 acres or 500,000 acres. If you've cornered the animal against the fence, it's not fair chase.
Yes. Well, I think, like you said, it's based on the animal you're chasing. And so let's say like an average range of a white-tailed deer is a square mile. Is it then ethical to say if the fence covers a square mile, then that whitetail on average has enough room to roam that he could naturally have patterns and he would be not restricted by fences. Mm-hmm. You feel like that's true?
He's still restricted though.
Yep. What about 2 miles? Now twice his average range.
Still restricted.
What about 3 miles?
I don't know what the cutoff's going to be, because I guess if you go to the extreme and let's just say we put a fence around lower 48.
Yep.
Which, in a way, you kind of have, because we have fences on borders that, you know, it's sometimes they're not made for wildlife to pass through. And then on either coast, you have these things called oceans, which prevent most animals from moving that direction.
Large bodies of salty water.
So, you know, we have some sort of enclosure.
We do.
But obviously it's all fair chase.
Yes. I hunted in Texas on a high fence ranch some years ago. Mm-hmm. I was working for Peterson's Hunting Magazine, and a certain company called me up and said, hey, we'd like to do this hunt, film it for a television show. And I said, well, I don't do high fence, so I'd rather not go. They said, hey, we would love for you to come down and experience it since you've never done it, and then write about your experience as to whether it's fair chase or not.
Mm-hmm.
This I remember this particular place was about a little bit over 5,000 acres. It had once been they had once bred deer there, but it had been years since they had actually bred any deer there. So there were breeder deer in the fence, but they had not been actively, caught, captured, and bred at any point. So they posited to me like, hey, after the hunt was over, which it was not fair chase. I mean, we did a lot of things that were, like drive past a deer that was bedded, get out, slam the door, it would run, and then we would chase it and kill it. That's what they'd like to do.
Okay.
So that it's not fair chase. But they would say, hey, look, you got after that deer. You saw that deer. We went after it, tried to kill it. It got away.
Mm-hmm.
Fair chase. That's what they kept saying to me. If you pursue a deer and it can get away from you, or you can hunt it for multiple days and not kill it, then that's it's fair enough for the animal.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
The fair chase. If it can get away from you effectively, it's fair. What do you got, Yanni?
That sounds fair. Does sound fair. Yeah, I guess as long as you never use the fence to your advantage. Maybe that's a caveat I'd throw in there. If you wanted to call it fair chase.
Yeah, but I think the fence is, whether you use the fence or not, you're still an advantage. Whether you run them up against the fence or not, the fence still gives you an advantage over somebody that's hunting where there is no fence.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are we going to say? What's the final verdict? Is there an acreage that is significant enough that you would say it's fair chase? Knowing that the oceans
I would have to just, I guess, wonder, like, what significance is the fence then for where you're at? Like, are there just a bunch of exotics in there? Is that the reason for the high fence? Are you trying to keep something inside of there that you don't want to get out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places in the world where they're like, you know, Africa is being one. We put up fences to keep poachers out.
Right.
You know, not to keep the animals in. And there's a lot, you know, a lot of people in Texas will tell you the same thing. But even for me, like, if you take it back to our model of wildlife conservation, you know, animals are held in trust by the states and belong to everyone. So as soon as you put up a fence.
Yep, that's right. They don't belong to everyone.
They don't belong to everyone. So, but just as a principle to me, the fence is a problem. Now, when it gets into, like, the fence exists and you can't do anything about it, is there some fair chase that could be had inside that fence? I would say principally, maybe. But the hunter then can't say, oh, when given the option, I take the high fence and have any scruples. You gotta avoid that at all costs, mm-hmm. I would say.
Yeah, I mean, can you go to a ranch like that and get real world hunting scenarios where you're going to get blown out and be frustrated and learn hunting skills by going there and chasing these animals? For sure. But like you're saying, it always gives you an advantage.
Yeah, there's nothing you
somewhat
can do.
Slight, but it always gives you an advantage. Yeah,
there's really nothing you can do about it. All right, well, don't.
So I can't decide on a size.
Don't hunt high fence. Just don't do it. If you do it, you can make up a story about it being fair chase, but there's always going to be an argument against that. You're never going to have a pure, you know, we talk about purity scale. You're never going to have a high score.
No.
There's a fence involved. You're just not. You may be able to talk yourself into fair chase, but it's really, at the end of the day, it's not as pure as it could be, no matter how big the fence is. Here's another one. This is from Crozy Talk. He said, I have a question. Thank you. Is it ethical to take a tree stand that is left on public land? In Minnesota, it is illegal to leave a stand on public land in most of the state. I'm interested in hearing your opinion on tree stands or trail cameras left on public lands. What do you think, Yanni?
I think yes. If you've watched that stand and it's past the a lot of time that it's allowed to be there, and if it's got the dude's name and number on it, you should probably call him before you walk out of the woods with it. But yeah, if someone's being lazy, doesn't want to pack their stand back out of the woods like they're supposed to, I don't have any problem with it.
So you're now, you feel like you're policing the public land.
I wouldn't consider it like you're doing any sort of policing. I mean, I guess if that's his motivation, I would say you don't need to go police somebody. But if you're like, hey, I'll use that stand somewhere and I'll pack it in and out of the woods. I'll clean up the woods. Because it is nice not to have woods full of tree stands.
Yeah.
Yes. Like that's what's happened on a lot of private property across the Midwest where I've hunted deer. And it gets a little it kills the zen feeling of just walking through the woods and just like every corner of every ridge intersection.
Ladders sticking everywhere.
Yeah. And then the ladders that are rotten and have fallen over are just there in the graveyard. And there's a new ladder just standing where it used to stand.
Yeah, but now
experience.
Now, guys, especially like you said, on private land, now dudes are, you know, hanging three stands for wind direction.
Right.
Like, we got a southeast wind, I got to sit here. And within, you know, a quarter square mile or within a small area, you got three or four stands hanging just depending on where the wind's blowing. Mm-hmm. And if you do that four or five times over, then you've got 15, 20 stands on however big a property you got. But when it comes to public land, I mean, I think obviously it depends on what the rules are. But in the case of Minnesota, where this guy's saying it's illegal to leave them up over a certain amount of time, I mean, I tend to be a, you know, a bit of a pacifist where this is concerned, I'd probably leave it alone unless I felt it was really hindering my or anyone else's hunting. Mm-hmm. Probably leave it alone. But if I felt it was kind of egregious where it was, or you know, was in a hunting spot that I valued and I knew nobody came back to get it, I'd probably remove it. But I wouldn't just out of principle walk over and grab one that I didn't think had a negative effect on me specifically.
Would you take it just because you needed a stand and you're like, well,
that's clearly
that one's been there long enough.
I'll take it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, once you, if the rule says you can't leave it there, and I think the person that hangs a stand, if you hang a stand and leave it up there for 3 weeks and know that's against the rules, and you come back and it's gone, you can't bitch.
Oh, hell no. You're
forfeiting your stand. So whatever happens to it, you can't bitch. So I would say ethically, this guy's probably, as long as he's thought about it and constructively thought, hey, is this, let me give this a little bit of time, and then I'm taking it down.
Yeah.
And didn't say like, oh man, I forgot my stand. Pull this one down and hang it up somewhere else. Or yeah. You're not
advocating that you go steal stands.
Don't be a dick is what I guess what I'll say.
That's right.
Do it for a good reason. But feel free to do it if somebody leaves it up there too long. That's where I land on that one.
Agreed. So it's ethically okay.
I think it's ethically okay. I don't know. Like I said, I'm more passive on this, so I don't know what I would do, but I would probably avoid taking it unless I felt like I had to take it. That's what I feel. Next one came from HardT96. Why are some bow hunters okay with just slapping a bow together without testing their equipment? Then when they make bad shots or their gear isn't effective, they don't try to improve themselves or their gear to ensure that they are bow hunting as ethically as possible.
The question is, why are they okay with that?
Well, I think the question ends up being, are you an unethical hunter if you are not tending to your gear properly? And why are you okay? And I know, like, if you bow hunt, you know people that are weekend warriors that aren't spending the time with their equipment that they need mm-hmm. to. And it doesn't mean they're lazy. It doesn't mean they're assholes. It just means maybe they don't have enough time and they still want to go hunting. But does that make you an unethical hunter?
See, I feel like there is a little bit of laziness involved there.
Yeah. Yep. Well, there may be like a prioritization issue. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you prioritizing over that? Because when you're going out, if you don't have time to practice, you don't have time to hunt, in my opinion. That's what I would say. You agree with that?
Yeah, and obviously it's a personal decision, you know. You can do that, and I guess if you value just being able to go out there and hunt and fling arrows over taking the time to practice so that you're not just flinging arrows, that's your decision. We can't tell you that. I can tell you that it's ethically wrong.
But is it ethical? Well, yeah. I mean, it's to what level you want to apply those ethics, right?
Like, yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to apply my ethics to them. But what I like to do is practice a whole bunch and be feeling like I'm, you know, doing the best job that I can, you know, when I'm going to shoot at an animal.
Is that your threshold for being an ethical bow hunter, having, like, done your best to make a good shot?
Yeah. Big part of it.
So then if you apply, if you're like, okay, if that's what an ethical bow hunter is, someone who has done their to the best of their effort, trained and practiced and tuned their equipment to make sure that they can make the shot when it presents itself. You know, if you screw it up in the moment, you screw up in the moment. I mean, that's happened to everybody in their hunting lives. It just happens. But for me, to be an ethical bow hunter, you have to be in the pursuit of getting better all the time to be an ethical bow hunter. You're going to start out really terrible. You might be really terrible for quite some time, but you can't be lazy enough or apathetic enough to not be getting better. Like, just to pick your bow up once a year, shoot it at 20 yards, hit 2-3 arrows near the bullseye and go out and hunt. Because you're not improving by doing that. But you have to be to be an ethical hunter, always getting better, always learning more, always like you have to, I think. Because if you don't,
then. Are you talking about specifically with shooting your bow? Or yeah. What if you just spend all that time just learning to be a better tracker and a better guy picking out better stand locations so that you get closer, more closer shots?
Yeah, that's a good point. But when's it become about the one thing?
If we're talking about slapping bows together.
Yeah, let's get back to just slapping a bow together. Because yeah. If you're not sighted in, if your draw length isn't right, if your peep sight's not set right.
Yeah, and this could apply to muzzleloaders,
rifles, anything.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably more prevalent in archery because there is such a wide gap between buying a bow and knowing what to do with it, I believe. And there's also a big old fat gap between going and buying a bow at a bow shop and buying it from somebody that's knowledgeable and that can point you in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we had a buddy that came to bear camp with us that had a thumb release and was shooting it the wrong way. He was shooting it with his knuckles on his cheek as opposed to like this. He had gone to a bow shop. Somebody sold him that and told him to do it.
Mm.
So and he put a photo on Instagram. And he's got a lot of followers, and people just blew him up for it. His draw length was an inch too short. He had his release turned the wrong way.
And he went to a pro shop?
Yeah.
Jeez.
One in Texas. And that's what he got. And so I think there's like a gap there too. So you like trust someone to tell you to do it the right way.
Yeah.
You know? So what's your responsibility in the end, Yanni? What's your responsibility as to the working nature of your equipment?
Well, I think you're going to have to decide just maybe always continuing to get better. Maybe that's a good way to put it. But you have to decide at what level you're ethically comfortable at that moment. And I think that maybe it speaks to being ethical when there are times when you say, you know what, I haven't shot enough or my equipment's not dialed in enough. And instead of going hunting, I should go do that.
Yeah, I've done that a lot.
Being
traveling.
An ethical hunter just means having that conversation with yourself.
Have you ever done that? Like, got to a trip and been like, I got to take a day off hunting so I can get my stuff dialed?
I've definitely, we did that in Michigan this last time. We didn't hunt like our first morning in camp because we knew we just had to, shoot bows a little bit and get dialed in. You know, that's so important when you travel to hunt because air pressure is different, your different altitude, humidity, your bow just traveled. You got to shoot, man.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, no, I've done that. I do that a lot. When you get into camp and you have either an outfitter or your buddy's like, let's go, go ahead and get a tree. Like, chill. Like, like you said, you can then put yourself in a scenario where you only have like 20-yard shots, where very high probability you can make that shot. Don't sit yourself on a field edge where a deer can walk 100 yards, 80 yards, 50 yards. Sit yourself on get yourself in a thick spot in between with a lot of cover where deer are coming in tight on you and stuff like that. You can do that to mitigate it, but that again is just being aware that maybe your equipment isn't where it needs to be and setting yourself up for success rather than just climbing in the same old tree with the same old bow that you shot once in September. Now it's November.
Yeah, and I don't want to single out bow hunters for feeling like they do that anymore.
No.
As a guide, man, I saw it across the board. Dudes coming in, you pick up their rifle and look through it, and their crosshairs look like an X. Like, really? Have you looked through your scope any time in the last, I don't know, decade? Yeah. Like... obviously they didn't prepare themselves.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's and I have some first world problems. I'm sure you guys too shooting the Meteor show. It's like you get into this like travel, always using different weapons. And you're like, well, I got 3 days before my trip and my wife needs me to do this, this, and this. I'm really busy at work. Shit, I didn't make it to the range. I'm gonna go anyway. I'll take this rifle and when I get there I'll shoot it in. Then when you get there, like, well, we don't really have a range for you. Just shoot once over that rock. And you shoot, and you're like, I think I hit it. That's good. And then you go out and hunt with a rifle you're not sure about. Next thing you know, you crack one in the freaking ear or shoot its leg off. And then looking back, you're like, whoa, that's my fault. Mm-hmm. That is my fault. That's the worst case scenario. Or your buddy's like, I'll bring a rifle for you. Don't worry. I shot it in. I sighted it in for you. And you get there and they hand it to you and you go hunt and you shoot one in the ass and wonder why. So same with rifles. I mean, that probably happens more. Nobody just like hands you a bow and says, hey, here, shoot my bow.
No.
Usually. So it can happen more with rifles probably than archery tackle.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been the one that handed them over and I've been the one that has taken them. And I always, anytime, even though I know that I took that gun to the range and shot a nice group with it, I always tell them, like, you should go shoot it.
Yeah.
You could just as much for the ethics as I just want to know that I'm going to kill something.
Confidence, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where, like, ethics and hunting gets a little bit shady because, you know, there is everything's everybody's different and you apply different things in different situations, but at the same time, like, your ability to kill the thing is part of your ethical responsibility. I think you can't disconnect the two at the very least. And so, you know, you can prepare and prepare and prepare and then always lose it in the moment, you know.
Yeah,
but I think that's okay. But if you don't prepare, then you can't call yourself an ethical hunter if you don't care enough to get prepared.
No.
Okay, this next one, Lance BR. He says, here's one for you. We live in Saskatchewan, Canada. A friend of mine had been hunting a property owned by his dad purely for hunting purposes. So the dad owned this property purely for hunting purposes. We've harvested elk and moose from the same area, and we always have a great time whitetail hunting there. In past years, we've all hunted it together, including his dad and the property owner. We've had a great time. So this year, I invested a ton of time, weekends, trail cams, stands to help get ready for a great whitetail week in November to try and target some of the mature bucks we've been seeing. Just yesterday, 8 days before general season, he tells me he would prefer to hunt it only with his dad to make sure they get the big bucks for themselves. I'm left with a week off from work and nowhere to go.
Oh, that's cold.
Yeah. What the hell do I do? He also says,
I don't see an ethics question there.
He also says, I don't want to be a slime ball, but I kind of feel like I got screwed over. They're a great family and good friends, but I'm a little confused as to why it took them so long to let me know. Any thoughts or advice or how to handle this situation? I think this would probably go back to ethically in the situation of his friend and the dad. How do you handle that situation? If you have like a, and I've been in this situation before where I had a really good friend who had a lease. I wasn't on the lease or paying for it, but he always let me go. Mm-hmm. And then I always knew that because I didn't pay at any time, he'd be like, hey man, booked up, can't go.
Yeah.
So I didn't have any expectation, even though I helped him hang tree stands and hunted there a lot and killed deer there, that at any point in time that it was their prerogative to tell me, stay home, homie. So I think the ethical question here is, if you're the friend and the dad, how do you manage that?
Like how should the friend and the dad be acting?
Yeah, you got a guy, you got a buddy.
It's been doing a bunch of work for you.
They've been cranking work for you, and you've expressed to him that you can hunt this week, and thanks for all your work, and that's you paying your dues enough to hunt. And then on the back end decide like, rather just be the two of us.
Yeah, I think you're being a little greedy, and.
Little bit of a,
yeah. Think of all kinds of bad names to call you.
A little bit of a dick.
Yeah, like.
But I think overall the question then becomes like, how do you handle that relationship as the person who's doing the work but not guaranteed a spot, and the person who has.
I mean, it depends on how well he knows that family. But I mean, if I was in his shoes, I'd have a real serious sit down with him and be like, "Look, man, I feel like I got kind of burned on this thing. been putting a lot of effort into it. You know, I don't know. I mean, I understand it's your property, but, you know, we kind of had this understanding and, you know, let them react to you bringing that up. And hopefully if you guys are good friends and you can put it all on the table and discuss it and come up with a solution, but, yeah.
Don't be a dick.
That's kind of like, you could lose a friendship over doing something.
Have you
like
ever
that.
Had like, I had a cousin growing up that we had, were very contentious over hunting spots. And like, he was always very jealous. And we always, and I know a lot of people have lost friends over hunting spots and lost friends over like permissions and mm-hmm. like, and people get weird, especially in the whitetail world where you're like, we're managing for bucks and somebody shoots the wrong one or.
Sure.
Have you ever lost a friend over something like that?
No.
Or gotten a big, yeah. No, never.
I haven't. No, because we hunted like this pretty much the same private land in, growing up for deer, and that never came up. And then when I moved out west, I started hunting mostly public land, and I don't know, never really abused spots that I was taken to, I guess. And it never came up.
It came up for me when I was a younger kid, but then once I got older, you just pick people to hunt with and pick landowners and spots where you don't think you're going to get into that. But I know Mark Kenyon, it wasn't probably wasn't punitive or, you know, the guy wasn't being a dick, but had an agreement with the landowner and drove all the way out to, I think it was Nebraska or somewhere, and mm-hmm. got there, and the guy was like, ah, it's not going to work. Somebody else is hunting this. And in that situation, you can't get mad. You just be like, oh, well.
No, you can't.
It's his prerogative. But if it's a friend of yours...
Yeah, it's been investing all kinds of time and money.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, you're being a dick.
Don't be a dick. That's a t-shirt. You think that's a t-shirt, Yanni? Yeah.
Yeah, be nice. Don't be nice. Be a dick.
Be real nice.
Yeah, I feel terrible if we had to start putting that on t-shirts. People should just know that.
Well,
parents, tell your kids.
Don't be nice.
Be nice.
Be real nice.
We tell that to our kids daily.
You do? Be nice?
Oh, yeah.
To each other or just be
everybody.
Nice to
everybody?
They be nice to everybody.
Whatever. Yeah.
I learned
from another good friend of ours, Carmen. I heard her tell her kids when they were being little shits. And I forget what sort of how the outlash is happening, but somebody they're not being nice.
Yeah,
some way she said, "Look, I know that you may be tired, you may be hungry, we may have a dirty diaper, whatever it might be, but the one thing that we are not allowed to do is be nasty," which is kind of like saying, "Be nice."
Be nice.
And I really like that. And it worked. It seemed to like make her kid kind of stop and be like, okay, you're right. I like to drop that on my kids a lot of times too. Be like, look, man, I know something's got you all fired up, but it does not allow you to react in the way you're reacting to the problem right now. You can still have a really bad day and just sort of like grace is like something that's still, I think, above them. And I haven't really introduced like the idea of grace, which I'm going to hammer on them later in life.
Yeah.
But right now it's just like, be nice.
Yeah. I mean, even my 2-year old, like he learned timeout pretty quickly when he's like, and now he puts himself in timeout.
Really?
Yeah. Walks over and sits down and puts himself in timeout because
he self-regulates himself. He's like, I've been being a dick. Need to go to timeout.
He'll do something and I'll be like, James. And he'll just like turn around and walk over and sit down. And he has like this weird awareness of, you know, he knows, at least he knows that his mother and I are like the judges now of, cause he just doesn't have as much awareness to know, but he knows he has enough awareness to realize that like when we're upset, something's gone wrong here. And I need to shape it up and be nicer. And so he always like, he'll get carried away emotionally as a 2-year-old always does and like maybe swing and hit somebody and immediately go put himself in timeout and I'll stand him up and I'll be like hug and kiss and he'll hug and kiss and then go and give everybody, like almost immediately understands like, oh crap. So I hope that continues. Hope we don't lose that along the way. But even for a 2-year-old, there's definitely some realizations that that little kid has. There's one here about coyotes. I'm going to find it that I like. Good bit.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
And really, it just comes back to morals and ethics around shooting something and maybe not killing it. This is from Brock Stuber, or Stubber, however you say your name, Brock. I have an ethics / morals question in regards to hunting coyotes. I guess the issue I run into when predator hunting is the fact that the animal is wasted. I've shot coyotes over the years, and I hate the feeling of wasting the animal and leaving it lay. At the same time, coyote hunting is a great excuse for me to get in the woods, and permissions to hunt coyotes is easy to get. Is this something that I'll need to get over and just look at the positives of having the opportunity to hunt? I suppose I could take the hides from the coyotes like I do when I get a bobcat, but even then, I don't know if the hides, if I'd have the time to tan the hides I get already from other critters. I also look at it from a deer preservation standpoint too, but I don't know if I can get on board with that whole thing. I feel like people disrespect the coyote because it's a predator and does what it needs to survive. Maybe I'm overthinking this, but I'd love to hear your viewpoint on this topic. Thanks, Brock. Shooting coyotes, leaving them lay, is that ethical and moral?
Man, that's a real personal ethics, moral question. For me, it just doesn't feel right.
I can agree with that.
And I actually don't like, I don't think that it's ethically wrong. I really don't. But something inside of me, it just doesn't feel right.
Well, we've all met the hunter / rancher / landowner that says every time you see a coyote or bobcat or any type of predator, you whack it. Mm-hmm. If it's legal, you whack it. If it's illegal, shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in that situation a lot with badgers, with coyotes, with anything, really. Even in Montana here some years ago with wolves.
Yeah. And that's all it really takes for me to be, spun over to like it, maybe not feeling bad about it at all, is if all of a sudden, you know, at my place we had in 2 years, it turns into we have like a little hobby farm and there's, I don't know, 50 chickens, and there's, you know, constant issues with coyotes or foxes, like, they're going to be getting killed.
Yeah.
May or may not be using the fur. I think mostly I probably would.
You would at least think about it. You would be shooting them and toss them in a ditch.
But again, it's like a coyote fur. Someone can write in and tell us like what to do with them. I have some from friends that have just given me coyotes that they trapped that were tanned, and it's a great decoration.
They can in the wintertime, they can be really nice. But you're not going to wear them.
That's my question.
What are you doing?
You might line like your hood on your jacket. Which I've actually been thinking about
which
doing.
Which would be cool.
Because, it's like a very technically proven like way to keep like sort of like a buffer of air in front of your face and keep the wind off your face. But, what else are you going to do with it? I mean, you might be able to trim out a jacket for your gal.
Yeah.
You know, look up
I'm looking up the shooting coyotes. Make more coyotes. I don't know. That's a shitty Google term, but I've heard from a lot of biologists, several biologists, that shooting coyotes creates more coyotes anyway.
Yeah. Well, you can listen to Dan Flores talk about, he studied up real good on coyotes when he wrote Coyote America.
Yeah, that's a great dude to talk about this with.
I mean, the one takeaway from that whole conversation in that book is that we have tried our asses off for over 100 years to extirpate that species. Tried very hard. Dynamite and poison and aerial gunning. And the coyote is too badass for us.
Yeah. It wasn't too long ago that they were only west of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, just think of an animal that lives in swamps. It lives in prairies. It lives in forests. It lives in anywhere.
It's like water, man. It just hits a barrier and just goes around it.
Yeah. So there's an article from Outdoor Life by a feller named, what's your name there? Guy, author, man, Dave Kramer. This is from 2016, but he basically just goes through and is talking about how it's situational. In some situations, it's great, and others, not so much. And so that's one thing to think about when you're shooting coyotes. Like, are you just like, I think from what this guy's saying, he likes to go have the hunting opportunity. It's fun. Like, there's the fun thing again. You're out at a time when you like a lot of other seasons aren't open. Mm-hmm. So what you would consider like an off season of hunting, you can always fall back on predator control. But all that being said, that's kind of complicated and situational. What isn't situational is that you're shooting an animal and leaving it lay, and you're really not intending to use any part of it. So erase all that other stuff. Like,
and you're
all
doing it just for fun.
Yeah, it's fun, and you're shooting an animal and leaving it lay. For me, I wasn't always with you, but I am at this point in my life. Like, I do not desire to go shoot things and throw them in ditches. I just don't. And no. I don't think it's wrong for someone to
do it.
Without a reason.
Yeah.
Right. If some rancher came
for
to me
for fun.
Yeah. If some rancher came to me and said, "Hey, look, I know you've been mule deer hunting on my ranch. If you don't mind, as a favor to me for muley hunting on my ranch, do you mind coming up in February and shooting a half dozen coyotes, or spending a week and shooting as many coyotes as you can get? Because I've got a glut of coyotes and they're bothering my livestock, and I need your help with that." I'd be like, "Yeah, sure, no problem." Because then I'm like, I have a reason to do it. But if I'm sitting around on the couch, I'm like, God,
then you don't feel like the blood's on your hands.
No,
so much.
Not as much. But there still is a reason. Like, I still am.
But if you don't necessarily agree with his reasoning, are you just sort of like making an excuse that okay?
You're right. I would have to agree with his reasoning first. So, like, I think reasoning is having a reason to do what you're doing is at the crux of all these questions. Almost every one of these questions is, what is the reason you're doing what you're doing? So coyotes is no different. It's like, what's the reason you're doing it? Because you're sitting around on Saturday and there's no football on, and you're used to going out and chasing deer, and really the only way to get outside and kill stuff is to go kill coyotes. Like, listen, man, like that's a dangerous road to go on, because then you're just, you need an excuse to kill stuff, and coyotes ends up being it.
Yeah, you're not gonna eat it. I've tried one; wasn't that good.
What's the flavor profile?
I would say, you know, it was very like stinky duck.
Really?
Yeah, like diver duckish. That kind of like a livery profile.
No, oh, that's never good.
Mm-mm.
Any game meat with a livery profile is,
yeah, like real high iron.
It's never.
The only thing that should taste like liver is liver.
And even liver, hopefully, doesn't taste like liver. So, what do you like? What do you, you know? What's the? Are you standing on that ground, or do you look down on other people that do that? That might say like,
no,
yeah,
I do again, it for fun. Because I don't like. It's legal, and I don't think that like. Again, personally, I don't think my ethics are necessarily against. Well, my personal ethics are against killing stuff and letting it lay.
Yeah, that's where I that's like my first thought is, if I'm killing it and letting it lay, there better be a damn good reason to do it. There better be a real sound reason to do it, and I'll have to have thought it through pretty good. I used to not be like that. I used to be like, oh, there's one, shoot it, bam, dead, cool. I'm saving the deer. But not really knowing if that's what I'm doing or not. So I think a lot of hunters get in that situation where, oh, saving the deer, shot that coyote. Really? Are you? Like, maybe you want to look into that before you kill something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe look into what really is going on.
Okay, but here's where it gets. I'm going to keep going on this one because it's we talked about this last week a little bit. Because the coyote sort of dictates that we have this conversation about whether it's okay to throw it in the ditch or not after you kill it.
Yeah.
As you go smaller and smaller down the chain of living things,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you're a vegan, I don't know how to make like the picturesque Buddha, like just like the happiest person that's most in tune with the world.
Yeah.
Very few people are going to try to save 100 ants that are invading their kitchen and try to get them to like walk out of their house instead of just stomping on all of them or spraying them with bleach or however they decide to dispose of them.
Mm-hmm.
So like, why do we have these, like this sort of like cutoff line somewhere?
Yep.
Where yep. It's like,
there's some anthropomorphism in there, right? I mean, like if it has a face and it, and it has personality characteristics of, right. of humans.
Then all of a sudden our ethics are like, ooh, no, you can't kill it just to kill it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if this directly goes to what you're talking about, but I think hunters specifically love it and are unabashed in a lot of ways when the gloves come off. Like when it's like feral hogs, shoot them, don't worry about it.
Yeah, we have to kill them.
And then, like, this is a big thing that I have, like, this is ethically and morally where I kind of draw some lines, is, like, do hunters, like, I hunt for conservation and I hunt for the meat and I don't, you know, I don't enjoy the killing. But then when we take the gloves off, we're like, kill that thing. We need them all dead. And then we're in helicopters mowing shit down. We're hooping and hollering. We're throwing grenades at them. We're shooting them with, you know, semi-automatic ARs with IR lasers at night with night vision and having fun doing it and stacking them up like, oh, look at this. The gloves are off now. I've killed these in mass and I'm having a great time doing it.
But I feel like I've never done that particular thing. But one thing that I did once that we only did once, and I don't know if we ever talked about it, the opportunity still was there. We had because there was a pond that was, I don't know, 100 yards or so from the dirt road that ran up to the hunting cabin where the guests would stay, and it was 20 yards from our guide cabin. And one day we sat there and shot, I don't know, 500 rounds down at this pond at muskrats swimming around. No intention of going to pick up the muskrats. Now, at the time, were we having fun? Yes. But we did it, and it was like, even though we never talked about it, and the opportunity was always there. It was never something that we were like, let's go do that again. Right?
So you feel like you had to do it once to learn?
Yeah. And I almost feel like it's the same thing like you're kind of describing with the gloves off. I think there's very few people that like time and time again are just going to get their jollies from just mowing down and killing and killing and killing and killing and just continue to want more and more and more of it.
It's true. I get with you on that. You're saying like people are generally good. That's what you're saying. You're saying that people will generally realize the error of their ways a few dozen hogs into the run.
And I don't know if it's necessarily error, but I just don't think that like most people actually, like it's not that good that you want to repeat it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a study back, I don't know if it was in the 70s, but there's a study, I have to look it up now. There's a study about like the stages of hunting, stages of being a hunter. I feel like it's a little bit outdated now because I think it was in the 70s. But the first one was like fun shooting or something. Like, I love to shoot. That was like the first stage of hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, again, that ends up being a natural progression for people, I think. He's like, I love
adult onset hunters probably don't go through it as much, but when you're a 12-year-old boy, dude,
it's visceral for you. You're like, boop, 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 ha, ha. Like,
if it's alive, it should die.
Yeah, not every little boy with a BB gun shooting squirrels and birds in the head is a serial killer or some kind of unethical monster.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some natural progression of that.
Totally.
That
and
everybody
it doesn't
goes
last
to.
Forever.
No. No. So you're right. I think you're right in the fact that if you truly do enjoy the gloves off thing in perpetuity, you got a problem, man. Like
you might have to get
checked out. But yeah, I won't name the people that were in the helicopter, but I know
you were in the helicopter.
Well, I've been in a lot of situations where I've done helicopters once, but I've done two or three different times where it was like night hunting for hogs, and it was like IR lasers, full on helmets with drop down night vision, and we're shooting M4s suppressed, and we're rolling around like the fields of Texas like a little commando team, shooting as many hogs as we can get, and if we just so happen to shoot one square in the ass, not a big deal because it's just a hawk.
Mm.
It's an invasive species, so killing them all is what we're after.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the freaking slippery slope, man. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, and what I don't like about that is that killing them all and extirpating them is actually not what any one of those people wants.
No.
Because then they couldn't continue that fun activity of pretending like you're G.I. Joe.
Exactly. Exactly. And like that's where I've always been. I'm like you say like so that's where the bullshit comes in. This you came back. I know Steve has talked about Australia a lot. Around like
well yeah just recently with what's going on in New Zealand, right?
Yeah, they're starting to have to come to terms with, hey, we got a bunch of these non-natives and we love to hunt them, and our justification for hunting is around the fact that we are eliminating non-native animals.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the government says, hey, we'll step in and take care of that for you, let us just we'll get the helicopters and just do it for you, no worries, you're having to walk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no, don't do it.
Mm-mm.
Like, wait, what, isn't that what you were doing?
Yeah, which I think is fine. They're just, it's just causing them to rethink.
Rethink it.
And they're just going to have to say, you know what? I was wrong. There are all these other reasons that make this activity great for me.
Yeah. And so I think, I was wrong in that case. You'd be like, I was wrong in the way I presented my reasoning. I was wrong.
I reasoned it.
Well, I would like there to be a balance, right? Not to kill them all. So like when I shoot a thing, I'm not going to go out there and be like, here I am shooting this fox just because it's non-native. That's not the way. Like, hey, I'm shooting this predator because I believe, and I've done some research to the place that I'm at that says the shooting this fox is beneficial. Rather than like, it's not native, bam, dead. No excuse. Because if the government starts applying your own rationale to wildlife, then they're all going to die. So you better come up with a freaking better one just mm-hmm. in case of New Zealand, because then they'll just kill them all. There's nothing you can do. So we started out at coyotes and got to New Zealand. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I that's where I'm at. The older I get, the more I really want to have thought out the killing of a thing. That's just me. You're there too.
No, oh, for sure.
All right. Marshall Seedorf writes in, on an ongoing debate among my circle of hunting friends, what situation ranks higher on the hunting purity scale regarding archery antelope hunting? Now, look, before we get into his situations here, do you believe that the hunting purity scale has anything to do with ethics?
No.
Why not?
Because the hunting purity scale, man, it's just it's a totally made up thing that, again, is going to change on every person's experiences and
sounds like ethics, though.
Sex and right, but a scale requires other people to participate in the same scale.
Yeah.
Unless you're just going to walk around saying, on my own hunt purity scale,
I think that's what you do, though.
It rates like this.
Like, my feeling of purity on this hunt, my personal feeling is that it's an 8. What is your personal feeling? Oh, it's a 4. Because, you know, based on where you grew up in Texas, sitting over a feeder is fine. It could be an 8 or 9. If you grew up in Montana, sitting over a feeder is a 1 every time.
Yeah, so then what's the purpose of having the scale?
For your own personal satisfaction that you like. For me, this is a 10. So you can communicate to other hunters where your value systems lie. That's why I believe the purity scale is. So I'm like, you know what? Here's where my value systems are. 10 here. This is a 10. And you're like, nah, I'm a 5.
So just doing that as opposed to just explaining your personal morals and ethics around...
It's way easier to put a number on it, Yanni, than actually. No, but I think that's for me, public land's more pure. So for me, I don't really care. But it's a good way to judge because everybody certainly has different perspectives, as we've said with ethics too. So that's where I'm. But I can get with you on it being a useless, a useless
bull. I think it's fun to do while you're driving around in a truck.
Yeah, I'm not saying I would if the law came to me and they're like, hey, listen.
Yeah, but I'm not going to really apply it to some sort of my morals.
Yes. Well, we'll go through this anyway now. We've totally defunct this question. But
no, because it's fun.
It is fun. So what ranks higher on the purity scale regarding archery antelope hunting? Shooting an antelope from a blind on a waterhole you scouted and put up weeks prior to hunting season. Or shooting an antelope while driving through public land and rolling out of a moving car to quickly run off the road, draw and release before the antelope runs. Referred to by my friends as drive-by. So that's Marshall Seedorf. He's got these seem like two very specific things that probably happened during a specific hunt. So,
hunt purity on those.
I like how one is on public land. It sounds like they're both on public land, but he only mentions driving through public land. So, well, let's just assume they're both on public land.
Yeah, because...
somehow public land always makes it seem more pure. It's like, oh, you're on private land.
Tougher competition, usually. Usually animals got have a little more edge on them. But, man... I really appreciate what it takes to do that scouting, to set up that blind, to sit it with the right wind. There the work goes in beforehand, obviously, because once you're in it, in that dark house, animal comes in, they really shouldn't know you're there when you get the shot. But then to have the athletic prowess and the spatial awareness and the agility that it would take to roll out of a car and as you're rolling in the ditch, knock an arrow and then come up on a wary animal like an antelope
that doesn't pronghorn. Duck the string and run to creation before your arrow gets
roll there. Up, maintain your composure through your draw.
You're like some goddamn Rambo's character now.
Yeah, that's So I don't know. I can't say if one of those is more pure than the other.
Yeah, I
think he might be looking for us to say that somehow using that vehicle and rolling out of it is sort of maybe drop it down. Because I would say, oh, if he's like, oh, well, what about unrolling the window and sticking your rifle out and shooting it? Well, then it's like, sure, the other one's way more pure.
Well, road hunting is always, road hunting, if that's what that is always like this topic of, in my own circles and just in my own head, a topic of debate. Because there's places in the world where, just like hunting over bait is way better up in Quebec, where there's no other way to see the animals because the forest is so thick.
Mm-hmm.
There's some ranches that are so flat that you can't find a tit to go glass from. You know, in Wyoming, this is the case a lot of times. And so the way to cover country and find the animals is to get in a car and drive around.
Yeah.
And these animals are used to trucks, mm-hmm. so they'll mostly just stand there and watch you. And if while you're driving around looking for one you'd like to shoot, one happens to be right by the road, what are you going to do? Drive a mile away and then walk back to it? Like, you know. So for me, sometimes, like, okay, in certain situations, driving around looking for animals to shoot is I mean, it's not the worst thing in the world.
No, but again, I think it's one of those things that most people that are truly, really hunters. I'm speaking from my own experience because in Nebraska, where I've done a fair amount of deer hunting, it is legal to shoot out of the car once you're off. I think it's off the county road.
Yeah, you have to be all, yeah.
Yeah, you have to be on like a Forest Service road.
Well, in Montana, same. You have to be, if it's a county road, you have to be certain.
Yeah, but I don't think you can shoot out of the vehicle.
No, you can't shoot out of it. No, no, no.
Yeah,
no.
But in Nebraska, you can. Don't get out of the car. Just lean it over the rearview mirror. Cut loose while you're listening to Jimi Hendrix.
Yep.
We had a season where the right group of people were there that were all like very excited about this opportunity to do that. We did a bunch of it. You could kill a bunch of deer. I think we had 20 some deer hanging in the tree by the end of the week. Subsequent years, we just never did that again. Everybody was like, you know what? That was a thing that we did, and now we're going to choose to drive to a spot park and go walk and hunt because that's what we prefer to do.
I'm 100% with it. I would never put myself in the situation to go drive around. Like, that's not what I would choose to do. I would always put myself in a situation where I knew, you know, walking was the way. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, shit, when we were in Mexico last year, you could just as easily kill a nice coos buck for getting in the old side by side and riding around. I think
just as easily as glassing one up.
I think you cover more country, you'll run into one eventually.
You should try that this year. When we're back down next year, when we're back down there,
I will try it.
I want to see how it goes.
I'll let you know how my purity scale.
3 days into it, well,
I'll be chasing them all over the ranch.
That's kind of funny.
But it's always,
you bump into them here and there doing that.
So you got to have your rifle ready though.
You got to be ready.
But yeah, I mean, I think I would always, like, having done those things before, same with high fence, having done them, just like your question around like shooting coyotes or whacking a bunch of hogs, having done them, I now know for my own personal purity score, that ain't the way. So I'm never going to put myself in a situation where, you know, yeah, I'm hunting a ranch where driving around is the only way to get it done.
And it might be like the purity scale of a, the sum of a week of hunting where you've been pounding it for 5 days all over the mountains, no luck. On the sixth day, you're driving home from the morning hunt back to the lodge or camp or wherever, and all of a sudden there's X animal like just rolling over the ridge. Dude, I'm bailing out and going to go chase after it, or bailing out and laying down and get my rifle up for a shot.
The only moose I ever shot in my life, I was with Joe Rogan. I shot a moose that we were driving over to park and go walk cut blocks, and two giant bulls ran across the road. I jumped out, jumped across the bar ditch, ran up into the field and shot one. And I was super happy about that.
Right.
Like, I don't feel like that was a bad experience. We hunted hard, and that's what happened to be where the one was. But yeah, putting yourself in a situation where, hey, I'm hunting this ranch in New Mexico where, you know, you really just have to drive around. That's really the only way to get a look at, you know, what's there, or sit a water hole or whatever. If I had to pick, I'd sit a water hole. And so purity, I give the water hole the win over jumping out of any vehicle and doing anything, no matter how Rambo you look. Because I wonder, we'll have to ask Marshall, did somebody actually fucking do that?
I know guys that roll that program with mule deer in Kansas.
Yeah, my dad just
very went, effectively.
My dad was just out in Montana here in Broadus where it's flat, and he came back from a guided hunt. He was like, "You wouldn't have liked that." And I was like, "What do you mean I wouldn't like that?" He's like, "Yeah, it was just drive around in a truck, spotting deer, see one you want, get out, go after it. If you don't get it, go back to the truck, drive around some more." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. I would not have liked that." But for him, you know, he enjoyed himself. So I don't judge you for that. He's 60-something years old and mm-hmm. son his whole life. That's, you know, that's the way that
he
went.
He felt challenged.
He felt good. Challenged. It was cold. That they had to look over a lot of country. They did, you know, had a lot of fun, and it was more about the people and the experience and seeing the country. And he brought home, like, he was just about out of meat, brought home some meat. He was super happy with it. So purity scale 10, that's great for me. Like, I'm happy that he's happy. So when it comes down to that, like, you got people in your close hunting circles that are doing stuff like that, fucking just be supportive if they're not being fully morally assholes, or, you know, be supportive, I would say, at the end of the day, if they're not doing something you feel like you have to question.
Yeah, and again, a lot of times your morals, if you're having questions about your personal morals and ethics around hunting, if you follow the regs, you're probably going to be falling in a pretty safe place.
Yeah.
And most people will be like, say you're a responsible hunter.
You're doing pretty good. Okay, last one. What's your take on shooting does with fawn/deer of that year? I've always been of the opinion that once the spots are gone, they are able to survive on their own. That doesn't sound right. Meaning they are not relying on mother's milk. So if I choose to shoot the mother, I don't have to worry about the fawn's survival. And he goes over this is Corey Dukehart, by the way, and he goes over some situational stuff that that he's done, but he hunts a lot for meat, and has had some situations where he's wanted to shoot a nice big fat doe for meat, and she's had some youngins with her, and he's had to make some tough decisions, ethical decisions around that. What do you think Corey Dukehart should do, Yanni?
No problem.
No problemo?
No ethical conundrum for me.
Where do you draw the line? Is it spots? Is it 1 year, 2 years?
I think that the biologists have thought that through, that set up your hunting seasons, and that if there was a risk of, you know, hurting the population dynamics, herd health, whatever it might be, because you're shooting cows or does,
too close to breeding season, or too close to gestation or whatever.
Then they wouldn't have that.
I agree with that. I think that's a pretty simple one, and that's the right answer.
I killed a big fat doe in Michigan last week that had two fawns with her, and I felt a little bad about it. I did. Those fawns, like they're apt to do, hung around.
I was just going to ask you that because I've had that once before.
It kind of disappeared, like, once all the deer blew out from the shot, but then there just happened to be these two fawns that kept kind of circling through, you know? I'm not going to anthropomorphize. It's like, that's like the animal kingdom, and they're like, they're going to figure out their own thing within hours and
might be good
on.
For them. Yeah. Probably not. When I was young, maybe 15, 16, I shot a doe on like opening day rifle season with a family friend. And I remember walking up on this doe and being super excited, and then looking across and seeing a couple of fawns, you know, 50 yards away that I hadn't seen, and being like just sad, really sad, because I'm gutting this deer, and these deer circling me at 50 yards, you know, doing that thing where they're like breaking their neck to look and see what you're doing, whether that it's their mom or not, you know, type of thing. And so
they're not actually thinking that, though.
No. But they're like, what happened there? I think they're more just confused about what the hell just happened than they are. But there's no way to know that, right?
I don't know.
And so I remember being like very briefly, like, I'm not doing this again. But then pretty quickly realizing that's kind of the risk you take. when you're doing it. Like you said, I mean, it's kind of what you're doing every time you go out and kill something. So if you're shooting does, you're kind of doing it every time.
A lot of people have an ethical conundrum with, like, is there a certain age that you should let an animal get to before you kill it?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely with livestock and with factory farming have got rid of that. You ever you have veal or, you know, anything of that nature, we've definitely not say, hey, listen, a cow has to be grass-fed, free-range, and 3 years old. We don't do that. Mm-mm. We don't do that at all. In fact, we do the opposite, you know, like, hey.
As fast and as fat as possible.
And so if you're just talking meat-wise, then you kind of, there's a parallel there to me. And I'm not, you know, nobody's shooting does for the, you know, trophies. A lot of, most people shooting does are doing it for the meat. Cows, same. Any female critter. You're mostly time shooting it for the meat, I would say. I don't know, can't think of an issue with any other way you'd be doing it. Unless you're purely doing population control, which you should still eat the meat anyway. So, mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, I mean, shoot the doe and eat the meat. And if you're doing that, you're fine.
Yep. Don't worry about taking mom out of the herd.
Don't worry about it. Well, it's still snowing out here in Bozeman.
Yeah. I think we're supposed to get a few inches out of it. Mostly we're going to get some cold. I think it's going single digits tonight.
That's what they say. I like it for now. Come see me in February and I'll let you know.
Is it? It's not December yet.
No.
But it's been nice. It's been like the perfect fall, I think.
I'm
like,
you know,
didn't come too early. Now we're not sitting here going, oh man, I hope it starts snowing. Like we're getting some snow. It's good.
Being a new Bozeman mm-hmm. person, I feel like some of the winter stuff may be a little bit overstated, but I mean, it gets cold here, and but I think it's such a great place to live. People don't have very much to complain about, so they just roll it into like, what's the one bad thing that living here? Well, it gets really cold, but I mean, it's back where I'm from in Maryland, it snowed, you know, 6-8 inches yesterday, and it was 45 degrees here and really nice. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's situational. People like to talk about the weather.
That's right.
What's your Thanksgiving look like, Arian?
You know, we've got some friends in town. We're not doing any family, not doing any traveling. Friends in town, we're going to do a Friendsgiving, they like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, have a very loud room full of kids. And otherwise, I'm going to do some hunting around Thanksgiving.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, go walk the mountains.
Beautiful. I'll be back in Maryland with my family.
That's right. You're heading.
Yeah, we're last week there. I don't have a bunch of family in town and do that. Maybe get out and hunt a day. I doubt it, but maybe. And then we're coming back to Bozeman for good. We're closing our house on the 27th. So permanent residence.
Nice.
We're excited. So hopefully we solved all your ethical. You'll never have another ethical quandary about coyotes or shooting does or anything like that. Because Yanni has. You asked the eagle, and the eagle answered.
Thanks for having me on, Ben. It's fun.
Thanks for coming on, Yanni. That's it. That's all. This episode of the Hunting Collective is finished. Thank you to all of you for sending in your questions, your ethical quandaries, and thanks to Yanni Patelis for helping me do my best to answer those and to give our perspectives. What's up with all these difficult situations out in the woods? Well, we've all been there. So, again, great podcast. Thanks for tuning in. And next week, what's up next week? Who we got next week? Oh, shit. We got Charles Post. Charles Post coming up next week. Now, Charles has already been on twice, but I wanted to catch up with Charles in that one about grizzly bears and wildfires and all kinds of great topics. So hopefully you'll listen next week for that one. Another episode of the Hunting Collective. Until then, go to themeateater.com. You'll find everything Hunting Collective there. The huntingcollective.com is kind of dormant as we move the business over to Meat Eater Incorporated and have everything living on themeateater.com. So if you want to get everything in your inbox every single week, do me a favor and go over there and sign up for the newsletter. because the newsletter just comes right to your inbox and you click on that sucker and it'll be everything you want to know from Steve Rinella, from me, from April Vokey, from Mark Kenyon, from Pat Durkin, from just a bunch of people, a bunch of really smart people. So get over there, sign up for that, and let me know that you did. Hopefully you enjoy it. Until next time, thanks for joining us on The Hunting Collective. Bye.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.